The Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today, we'll be talking to Kirsty Shakespeare, manager of our International Education for Sustainable Development programme here at TSL, as part of our mini-series on climate action in response to the UN Climate Change Conference. Today's episode is hosted by Jasmine Barrett.
We are talking with Kirsty today. You have an interesting job title. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that and yourself and what you do at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Jasmine, for having me. So yeah, my name's Kirsty Shakespeare and I am the International Education for Sustainable Development Manager at the Trust for Sustainable Living, which basically means we are an education charity working both in the UK through our visitor centre in Hampstead Norreys, the Living Rainforest, but also globally through our international online education work, which is the area that I manage to engage young people and teachers around the world with sustainability and environmental education.
So I was wondering actually if we could tell our listeners a bit more about the Trust for Sustainable Living and what the organisation aims to do in terms of education.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Trust for Sustainable Living was set up as a charity in 2000. Based at the Living Rainforest Visitor Centre, which was established in the early 90s. And it was set up with a sustainability focus in mind. Carl Hansen, our executive director, comes from a sustainability background, and he felt there was a need for better access to sustainability education for students locally. In the UK, sustainability has been on and off the curriculum over that period. So it was an opportunity for us to engage with schools as part of their curriculum or engage a sort of extracurricular to get people more involved and more aware about sustainability using our Rainforest Visitor Centre so they could see examples of species that were threatened and then understand the links between their lives here in the UK and how that is affected by the rainforest. So for example, a lot of the foods that we eat, a lot of medicines that we take come from tropical rainforest species. More recently, we've been working online and internationally to try and engage people on a wider platform because sustainability is a global issue. There's local aspects to it, but if we think about things like climate change and global warming, that's a global issue. So if we can engage more students and more teachers around the world in this conversation, in this dialogue, and get people aware about it, we can start to see global changes, hopefully, and not just local changes. Mm-hmm. So we work to connect young people and teachers with resources and activities that educate them, but also empower them to create change within their own lives, within their schools, within their communities, to hopefully try and achieve a more sustainable future moving forward.
Definitely, because starting with education is obviously starting right at the bottom so that changes will hopefully be made right from the bottom of the system. But yeah. In your words, why is education an important part of addressing the climate crisis? You know, what role does education have in climate action?
I think for young people, as it's as important for adults as well as young people. If we don't know and understand what's happening, we can't do anything to change it. People generally want to live a convenient and comfortable life. And if there's ways that we can do that that are less damaging to the environment, that cause minimal impacts on that convenience or that ease of living, then we need to try and make those changes. So it's important for people to be aware of the impacts that they're having, so then they can make more informed choices about the food they're buying, the clothes they're buying, how they're traveling around using transport. Because if you don't have an understanding of that, you can never understand your impacts and how that's going to affect your life in future, your potential for having access to food, your potential for having access to energy or to medicines, all those things that our amazing planet provides us. Mm.
I think that's very important actually, because when people, especially adults, don't understand something, they push back against it. So by starting young and by making people understand that right from the very beginning, you're more likely to get climate action and stuff. but we wanted to know a little bit more about you as well. So we were wondering, when you first started your career, was the environmental and charitable sector where you wanted to go? Kind of how did you get into this industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So I did a zoology degree and a master's in ecology, evolution and conservation. And from a very, very young age, as far as back as I can remember, I'd always wanted to work with the environment, with animals. My dad was a keen bird watcher, so as a child, we'd spend quite a lot of time in the fields and forests around where I lived learning about birds. I was really inspired by David Attenborough, watching a lot of his shows when I was growing up. So it was always very clear in my mind and obvious to anyone that knew me that I'd be doing something working with animals and the environment. So after I graduated in 2009, which wasn't a great time to graduate because of the economic crash that happened then, it took quite a long time for me to find a degree-related job. So I worked in retail, I worked in recruitment for a while, continuing to maintain voluntary positions, working at a wildlife rescue centre to try and keep the experience up, working with animals and with the environment.
Mm.
And during my time at university and college, I did quite a lot of volunteering, working with schools and with young people to help them with their science projects and programmes that were being run. So when the position came up at the Living Rainforest for the education officer role, I thought, well, that combines my love and interest of science and my enjoyment of working with young people, and the experience matched. So it wasn't that I'd always planned to go into environmental education. It was more exploring, okay, this is the qualification I've got, where can I go from here? So it seemed like a good route to go down, because I enjoy sharing my passions with other people. So this was an ideal route to do that and share that with young people and get them excited, recognizing how important it was to have someone in life talking about science and the environment and nature. So
absolutely,
I hoped I could do that for more young people.
I never really thought, actually, you graduated in 2009, just after the economic crisis. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 2020 in the middle of a pandemic, so we've got some struggle there.
Yes.
But I was wondering a bit more about your experience in Thailand, which I think you've mentioned so far. But I was wondering if we could tell our listeners a bit about that and working out there, what made you decide to go in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So from 2012 to 2016, I worked at the Living Rainforest in my education officer role, which was doing site-based education visits for schools coming to our indoor rainforest. The opportunity came up in 2016 to go and work in Thailand for a company called the Tritop Three Generation Barge Programme, which basically was doing almost the flip. We were going out with schools doing residential field trips into real rainforests. So part of the appeal obviously was moving to Thailand, which is a fantastically interesting country in terms of its natural environments. You've got everything from cloud forests up in the north through tropical rainforests down to mangrove and seagrass on the coast. So it's got all of the incredible environments which I'm interested in, with more tropical ecology interests personally. But it was also doing a job role that was quite familiar to me. So continuing that love of environmental education, I was able to take students out into a real rainforest or a real cloud forest or a real mangrove and talk to them about the habitats, the species. They could see the impacts, they could make changes, we could do beach clean, so they could see positive impacts that they were actually doing. So I worked there for 4 years with a mixture of international schools that were based in Thailand, Thai schools, and also some international schools visiting from overseas that do a mixture of cultural programs and then different environmental programs themed around their curriculums, whatever they were studying. So we looked at Thai history, we looked at Thai culture, and how both of those are very strongly linked to the Chao Phraya River, which is the central river of Thailand. And then looking at the different habitats within the watershed and thinking about how those impacted on people's lives, on modern culture, on the development of the capital cities, and how still it plays a really important role in modern Thai culture and modern development as well.
What was your favourite topics that you covered?
I really love the rainforest, so I love doing the rainforest trips. A bit of all of them, to be fair. I didn't know much about Thai history and Thai culture before I went. So from my perspective, it was interesting to learn about Thai history and Thai culture. It's the only Southeast Asian country never to have been colonized by Europeans.
Hmm.
So they've got a very different cultural history to the rest of that area. Obviously, Myanmar and Vietnam and the other countries in that area were all colonized. So there's a lot of European influence, whereas Thailand doesn't have any of that. So it's interesting to see the differences between Thailand and the surrounding countries. So it was interesting to learn that. But also mangroves and marine life. I'm a keen scuba diver, so the opportunities to talk about those. Mangrove forests are in huge decline around the world, so that's a really important habitat we used to talk about. And there's amazing creatures that are only found in mangrove ecosystems, like mudskippers, which are really cool fish that look like frogs, that have got big googly eyes but can breathe outside of the water. So they've got lots of special adaptations. So I think the rainforests and then marine and mangrove, but also the Thai history and culture, because that was new to me. So it was interesting to learn about that and then share that with the other students about the country they were living in.
You mentioned there that you are a keen scuba diver.
Yep.
Where have you scuba dived?
Thailand. I actually learned and did my qualifications with PADI while I was at university. So I've done a couple of different dive sites in the Red Sea in Egypt around Dahab. I've also been lucky enough to dive in Oman, which had the most incredible soft corals I think I've seen anywhere in the world, which is really cool. The Seychelles I've dived as well. South Africa, again, that was a university trip that I went on as a graduate, which was part of hoping to become part of their marine biology course, which was looking at sharks. So we worked with a professor from Port Elizabeth who was looking at sharks. We helped to put down shark tracking devices, which send an electronic signal if a tagged shark goes past, and learned quite a lot about shark biology with them off the coast of South Africa. So that was amazing. I think that's it. Oh, Lanzarote as well. Ooh. So a little bit around Europe, mostly warm water diving. I'm not very good with cold, so it has to be somewhere I can wear a wetsuit if it's under about 20 degrees. That's a bit too chilly for me.
I mean, speaking of warm water diving, one of my aims is actually I would like to see the Great Barrier Reef before it obviously is on its way out. I would like to see it in its glory. So I think I've got a few years, but...
Yeah, I think it depends where you're going. Obviously, there's the last couple of years, they've had a lot of episodes of coral bleaching. So it is definitely... being impacted, and that's being seen you know, a lot more. So yes, if that's something I'd like to do as well. I've not been there, so I think we're gonna have to move quickly.
Get a move on. But going back to Thailand, one of the things that we've asked our guests, even in the previous season and in this season, who have either been in multiple places and stayed there for a while, is about the differences that they've noticed between the places that they've been in. So we spoke to Toby, who's a writer, last season about the differences between Nigeria and the UK. And we spoke to Growing Green Communities with Becky and Lucas about the differences between Thailand and Gambia. But we were wondering maybe if you could tell us a bit about what you've noticed in terms of the environmental awarenesses and other differences between the UK and Thailand.
Yeah, absolutely. So predominantly the main Thai religion is Buddhism. So about 90% of Thais are identified as Buddhist. And Buddhist culture, everything has a spirit. So the river has a spirit, trees have spirits, forests have spirits. So there's quite a lot of awareness or a certain respect for the environment built in from quite a young age because of that religious link. Which I don't think we have as much in the UK. So that's one of the things. So there's quite a lot more of awareness. There's still a lot of Thailand that's very reliant on the environment for their livelihoods. So either farmers or people working within tourism that are relying on people to come for the diving, for the beaches, for the forests. So there's quite a lot of awareness within those areas that people are visiting Thailand and there's income coming into the economy because of those reasons, which again, I don't think is quite as recognised in the UK. But I think in both countries, there's a difference between those that are living in urban environments and those that are in more rural environments. So in both places, If you're in a more rural environment and you're closer to nature, there tends to be a greater awareness of it than if you're living in an urban environment and you're in a big city. So some of the students that we work with in Bangkok have never been out to the national parks. They don't spend time outdoors. They're not within natural environments very often. So that's quite a different learning experience from someone that has grown up on the outskirts of Bangkok or in one of the villages or towns that's a smaller urban development, that perhaps have got family that are farmers and they help on the farm sowing the rice, or they help, you know, with the harvesting and those kind of things. So there's different levels of awareness based on the location that people are living. But definitely I think the spirituality of Buddhism and everything having a spirit, and that including nature, makes a difference as well. There's a lot more awareness in Thailand, I think, as well, of traditional medicines and plants, different plants. There's different types of teas and tonics that you can take to help stomach ache or those sort of things, which again, I think we've lost a lot of our traditional knowledge in the UK about medicinal plants or different types of food plants. We very much, you know, focus on going to the supermarkets and buying food from there rather than growing our own and having that link. So a lot of our, I think, indigenous knowledge about plants and the habitats that we're living in and what nature can provide for us, I think, has been lost a little bit more in the UK than it has in certainly parts of Thailand.
You've actually spoken there about two different really important kind of subjects that I've heard about recently in terms of in Thailand being able to, or being more connected to their local environment and relying on that local environment. Do you think that's a good thing? Because I have been reading a book called The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells, talking about how obviously we have such a global system that when one thing goes down, a lot of it kind of domino effect has negative effects throughout the system. But by relying more on your kind of local knowledge and your local species and your own kind of food and farming, you obviously don't get as affected by that. So I think it can be a good thing, because you also mentioned, you know, we go to the supermarkets and buy, at least here in the UK, a lot of our food or supplies, which come from all over the world. But at least if you have it locally, again, there's not as many issues when it comes to, there's not as many issues when it comes to a kink in the system then having negative effects. So some of the other things that we wanted to ask you about is more about what you've noticed in terms of the education. So over the course of your career so far in education for sustainable development, we were wondering over time what changes you've seen in terms of the perception of students and the reception you receive educating people about the environment.
Yeah, okay. So I think at the moment, sustainability is a real buzzword with the upcoming COP26 climate summit, with the COP15 summit that's been happening. There's been a lot more awareness about climate. And I think now that more countries, more people around the world are starting to experience the effects of climate change and global warming, it's becoming a more relevant and topical issue. You know, we've seen terrible wildfires this year across the States, across Europe, across Australia, across Russia, that typically we don't usually see. We've seen flooding, we've seen you know, lots of environmental disasters effectively, which are being, the frequency of which and the intensity of which are being increased by climate change. And I think that's raising more awareness in places that perhaps were a little bit more reticent to make any changes or reticent to agree that anything was happening because it wasn't directly affecting them. So I think definitely now there's a lot more awareness than there has been historically. Unfortunately, sustainability and the environment aren't on a lot of school curriculums, both in the UK and internationally. There are more curriculum systems that are moving on to having sustainability as part of their standardised education. And a lot of independent curriculums or schools do choose to put that in, but it's not necessarily a compulsory subject, which I think it should be, and which is what I hope we're going to be moving forward towards in terms of the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, is getting that in there.
Definitely.
Because as we said, education is so important, because once you understand it and it's built into your way of life, it's something you think about every day. It's not something you have to stop and consider when you're making personal choices or business choices and things like that. So I think people are definitely a lot more receptive to it. I think certainly publicly, there's a lot more acceptance that the climate change and, you know, the biodiversity crisis are a real thing. It is happening.
Mm-hmm.
There's no denying it now. It's just looking at how much we can change and reduce what we're doing to minimise those impacts. So I definitely think there's a lot more awareness. And I think students now are a lot more active in being wanting to be part of that change. I think children particularly still have such a love for the environment of any age that they want to help it. And I think it's not until they start getting into their teens or their early adult that sometimes is lost. But I'm seeing more mm-hmm. nowadays than when I started out 10 years ago, that that's continuing, and young people are becoming more vocal about what they want from world leaders and what they want from the environment and the protection that they feel is needed. So if you think about a lot of the young people that are working on the climate marches, and a lot of people that are doing a lot of biodiversity work, there's a lot more youth involvement now on a bigger global stage. So I think a lot of the global organisations like the IUCN are working with a lot more young people. The Convention for the Biological Diversity are also working with a lot of young people. So I think there's a lot more youth voices now being heard and recognised by adults and being brought to the forefront of the conversation, which is great. So,
I mean, definitely. I think one of the issues, though, with that is something we spoke about with Jhonpal Jose from India, in the episode before this one, or in an earlier episode, about some of those voices. Hang on, did we speak about that? About how, at least in his country, in India, the youth are still subject in a bit of a way to ageism and not being taken seriously. So I think, I mean, definitely there is way more youth voices, and you can see that impacting the environmentalism and the awareness of the whole kind of general population of the planet. Obviously, there's still steps to be made. And you've kind of touched on this bit already, but we were also wondering what differences between kind of the developed areas that you've worked with and the developing world. What have you noticed in terms of education, funding and awareness between those kind of different groups?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Obviously, in different countries, there are different priorities. And if you're thinking about those countries that are developing, they've obviously got a lot of priorities. So access to good healthcare, access to good education, access to sustainable jobs for people, access to development and the chance to access that convenience that we, you know, are lucky to have in a Western world. So I think it, you know, there's a lot of different priorities that happen there. But I think the important thing moving forward, and what I've seen certainly within Thailand and some of the other Southeast Asian countries, is that they're building the environment and sustainability into that development.
Yeah.
So it's not at the expense of the environment. It's, okay, we've got this amazing environment. How can we tie that in with developing sustainably? So I think that's one of the things that Western countries have done very badly, is that it's been extremely focused in the last 200 or 300 years on development at the expense of the environment. Mm-hmm. So I think the important thing now is that the countries that have gone through development and that have got this life of ease and convenience and the knowledge, the money, the funding, the technology
yep.
to help these developing countries now help and support them to achieve the same levels of development that we're lucky to have, and the ease and convenience of lifestyle that we've got, the access to medical care, quality education, etc., but do that working alongside the environment and biodiversity and not at the expense of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask actually what is needed to kind of bridge the gap between, well, you know, over the differences between developed world and developing nations, but you've kind of touched on that already with developing and Western countries, or developed and Western countries, kind of using their funding and their education and their knowledge that they have now, having gone through that, to help them along.
Yeah, I mean, as we've said, this is climate change, particularly, and the biodiversity crisis are a global problem. There's differences at local levels. Some countries are experiencing much greater impacts of climate change and biodiversity loss, typically the more developing nations that have got really high levels of biodiversity, have got really niche habitats than the more developed areas do. But I think we need to, you know, get them working together, and that sharing the knowledge, sharing the science, sharing what works from what we've experienced from those countries that have got the funding, that have got the scientific knowledge, have got access to that, to share with those, but also taking into account and not discounting the local knowledge, the local scientific knowledge, the indigenous knowledge, because if you're thinking on a more local scale, someone that lives in the area that's experienced it is going to have, you know, as much meaningful knowledge as a Western or more developed scientist coming in.
Yeah.
So it's about, you know, fusing those two together and using international knowledge, international funding, international education, but working with local people to find solutions that are going to work within their community, within their habitat and their environment. Because it's not a one solution fits all. It's a global problem, but the local challenges are different. So it's about everyone globally working to address local challenges.
I like that quote. It's a global problem, but the local challenges are different. I like that. And now we're reaching the end, but we do have one last question that we are asking our guests this season on climate action and the climate crisis and climate justice. And that is, if you could sit down with world leaders today and share your thoughts on the climate crisis and what's going on, what would you say to them?
I think it's time for action. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of talk, you know, the COP climate summits have been happening for 30 years. Climate awareness has been on the agenda really since the 70s. You know, that's 50 years of lots and lots of talk, and you know, some actions, some steps have been taken, some changes have been made. If you think about the ban on CFCs, I think in the late 80s and early 90s, which were affecting the whole of the ozone layer, banning those, we saw quite quickly had a big difference on the environment. So there have been some steps made, some progress has been made, but not enough. And I think it's time to stop talking and start acting. We know that world leaders need to make drastic changes to the way that we're living, that we're acting, that we're doing business. And it's time to start making those changes and not keep talking about what we'd like to do, because we're running out of time.
And I think it's important to note as well that it's only going to be better for them and their countries as the climate crisis continues to be adapted to that, to have funded into all the green technologies and policies. So, I mean, to be honest, I don't really get that.
Yeah, I mean, change is uncomfortable, and change is hard for anyone. So, you know, if we can get countries that are developing now to build this idea of sustainability and the environment into what they're doing, it's going to be much easier for them.
Yeah.
It's going to be harder for those countries that have already developed, have already got strong economies that are based on fossil fuels, to make the changes. But you know, we've got the technology, the money is out there. It just needs to be invested in the right places with the right people to start making those changes. And, you know, students can have an impact. Every individual can have an impact. But we need governments to start working from the top down so they can meet the bottom-up movement that's being led by schools, by young people, by individuals, so that we've got movement across the whole of a society, not just, you know, the people at the bottom, because you've seen a lot of action with the climate marches and, you know, Extinction Rebellion, and Greta Thunberg's obviously done a fantastic job getting this on the agenda for people. But I think we need world leaders now to step up. They need to make ambitious changes. They've got to set ambitious targets, and they've got to meet those and be held accountable towards meeting them.
Yep.
but they need to support each other in being able to do that. So the more developed countries need to support the less developed countries, but we need, you know, they need to be held accountable for their actions. We can't talk any longer. It's time to start making mm-hmm. real actions that are going to make a big difference to try and reduce the climate crisis that we're in and help reduce the biodiversity crisis that we're in as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming to talk to us today and for sharing all of your knowledge and all the things that you've learned. And hopefully it can be useful to some of our listeners as well.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Kirsty Shakespeare. Hosted by Jasmine Barrett. Organised by Jasmine Barrett and Sunny Tierney. Music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org. Thank you for listening.